point. So, welcome everybody. Those were three terrific keynotes this morning. Okay, joining our three keynoters are Manan Shah from Citrix and Adam Powers from V2 Solutions. So let's just give both Manan and Adam a minute to tell us about why they're up here today. So how does your organization work relevant to the future cloud opportunities for media and entertainment?
Sure. You want to start or should I?
Sure, I can start. So my name is Manan Shah. I'm a product manager for cloud platforms at Citrix. And one of the things that Citrix tries to do is, Citrix is a cloud computing company that enables mobile work styles. So as we have more and more handheld devices, and as our interaction with them changes over time, we want to build the cloud services to make sure the cloud services enable those mobile work styles in a seamless manner. And we have a lot of customers in the media and entertainment space where they are doing private cloud or public cloud, but most of the customers are looking towards a hybrid cloud and deploying their cloud orchestration software to start from DevOps to DevTest to rendering to a variety of different use cases and enabling those using the Citrix technologies. And that's why I'm here to talk about how Citrix enables those media entertainment customers to enable cloud use cases.
Thank you. Adam?
So V2 Solutions is a provider of metadata management services along with software engineering and analytics services. We've done a lot of work in terms of taking the data that's in different silos across all the different studios, trying to combine it together and provide analytics and workflow tools on top of it. So we think that the cloud is initially very operational inside the studios, making sure that they can find their assets, understand the rights around their assets, figure out their own schedules, share information across groups, across legal and marketing, across finance, across digital distribution and home media and all the other groups that sometimes have a hard time talking inside studios. And eventually we think that a lot of the future of data solutions for the studios is a lot of the stuff that Kurt was talking about in terms of advertising, in terms of being able to dynamically target marketing metadata towards consumers. So when you go to something like Netflix or go to Amazon or something like that, if you're a woman looking at Orange is the New Black on Netflix, you would see one description of it. If you're a man looking at Orange is the New Black on description, you would see a different description of it. Being able to do that sort of targeting and that sort of personalization of the face of the content, not of the content itself, but just of the description of it, we think it's a huge, huge future opportunity that requires a lot of information, a lot of cloud services.
Terrific, thank you. By the way, just one point, those $200 red Manolos, not happening.
Not for you.
Just thought I'd mention.
All right, Marty, you dodged the bullet there.
So, obviously, hopefully, I listened and the rest of us were listening to our keynoters. So, what did you hear in the keynotes that resonates most with your vision for what will be the single largest next opportunity for media and entertainment to benefit from cloud computing? And describe that opportunity for us. Mark?
I gotta say, it was the SAP guy.
Thank you, sir.
I'm a cloud guy, right? But I would agree 100% cloud is under mobility, mm-hmm. cloud is under social, cloud is underneath all this stuff. And so the real use cases for cloud always get me excited because, so I appreciate you sharing that with me, because I think that is the big wave, is this real-time analysis of what's going on out there amongst all this big data and how do we leverage it into money. Mm-hmm. So,
Grant.
I don't want to say me too, but...
Oh, that's a great answer. We
take a very focused approach on, not cloud for the sense of it's cool technology, but cloud from the sense of it makes business work. And that, we usually focus on the internals of a business, business process and all this kind of thing. But the revenue side of it, you know, is another big component that, that we don't often look at, whether by design or otherwise. So I think seeing media companies shift towards that, that direct-to-consumer model is very interesting. Very interesting. It's gonna take a while.
Well, I really appreciated what the other keynotes had, and it's interesting because I was an HP engineer some 20 years ago when like the beginning of rendering and other things came out. And I was actually there when we were filling rooms full of render servers and then trying the truck approach and you know, refrigerated 18-wheeler back-end trucks to be render farms, and was a part of HP when they started doing the render deals, right?
They're still doing that.
Well, absolutely. And what I'm finding now with the customers is that they're saying, look, we're an entertainment company, right? Our marketing spend at a major studio can be as high as $2 billion. What's the IT spend? It's in the 100 million range, right? So, and we're looking at, my God, where's our real estate? It's in Century City and in Burbank and in Sunland, where there's not enough cable under the ground to bring in enough power to put in a class one data center. So, you know, we're all having this little epiphany moment that says, look, we're really about finance, about legal, about marketing, right? Studios don't make movies, production companies make movies. We don't want heavy IT, right? We want to manage the technology, so we want cloud. And I know for myself, we've just gone through a reorganization because our internal goal is to be at a 70% cloud, 30% on-prem basis, not 30% cloud. So our customers are doing it, we're doing it, we're driven even faster because we are a technology-hungry industry, right? So all of this makes perfect sense to me, and it's the affirmation, it's the group having the right targets, and as a vendor community, you know, focusing on and supporting an industry. Because at the end of the day, I'm very industry-focused, and it's really great to see.
So one of the things that we have seen is cloud is essentially fundamentally changing the way every organization thinks about consuming the technology as well as delivering to their business units, whether it's rendering. For example, just talk about rendering. Earlier, you had to have enough CapEx investment to do rendering. Now with cloud and public cloud especially, smaller companies can go to Amazon and render in a much cheaper manner. They don't have to invest in CapEx. They don't have to have huge IT budgets to do any of the rendering that they need to do. So the way it's essentially leveling the playing field. And that is a big change that everyone in the media and entertainment industry is going towards. And the, because of that, every organization has to reevaluate their strategy, how much they are spending in-house, how much they are spending on something that's a marketing campaign. And for marketing campaigns, if it's a transitionary workload, then you don't really need to have like all the CapEx investment and have all the servers and all the compute power in-house for a longer period of time. You just go to Amazon or any other public cloud, use it for however long you need, and pay for what you use. And that's what is fundamentally changing the way people think within the media and entertainment industry.
I think I'd take a slightly different tone in terms of the future of how cloud services impact studios. I think that if you look at where studios sit right now, they're facing a really existential crisis in terms of millennials going in a very different direction with content, in terms of crowdfunded content, so people going to Kickstarter and Indiegogo and things like that. Looking out 10 years, they could be facing real problems if their audience starts to go to smaller content, shorter content, cheaper content. And the studios have built all this great infrastructure. I mean, they own the distribution channels through retail, through MVPDs. But those may very quickly become a chain around their neck rather than a real huge asset for them. The thing that I think that cloud really does for them in terms of how do they survive past 10 years is really provide them with a variety of services, this Chinese menu of services they can choose from and mix and match and innovate on top of. I think it gives them new distribution channels. I think it gives them new ways of reaching out to customers. I think it gives them new ways of interacting with audiences, new ways of producing content that can be cheaper, more effective. It gives them the analytics enables them to really understand their user base. I think that's really what Netflix has done so well in their production, is understand their audience and develop shows specifically for that audience. And I think that the studios, if they can actually figure out how to take all these different services that are out there, whether it's distribution services, whether it's transcoding services, whether it's editing services, whether it's analytics, take all these things that are out there and figure out how to play with them, how to innovate on top of them, and make sure that they're around a decade from now.
Thank you, very good. So, unfortunately, I'm listening to too many of you agreeing with each other, but you've got to have more here. So, what did you hear, either in the keynotes or what we've just discussed, that about that next big opportunity with which you disagree, or most disagree? So, which opportunity do you think, this is not going to be viable? So that you can't do a Me Too here, Grant.
Manon, something you just said made me think a little bit. This is a little tangential, which I apologize for, but do you think that the enablement of the smaller guy, right, to take advantage of something like Amazon, kind of level that playing field, how much do you think that scares the big guys that have a longstanding investment into their own assets and infrastructure? And because from their perspective, you know, they're, don't call them monopoly, but you know, they're in a very, very established position. How much does that threaten that position, you think?
So I would say for the most part, it does not really threaten, but it folk allows them to look at it in a different angle, through a different lens. If someone is doing it at a lot lower OPEX and a lot lower investment, then they have to reevaluate their strategy, and as an organization, everyone wants to be more profitable. So they have to reevaluate that strategy and decide for themselves, is this what we have been doing for the last 10 years the right way to do it? Or are there newer ways of doing things where I can leverage my investment more wisely, use the same dollars instead of investing in all of those CapEx, leverage for marketing, and maybe get more ROI of those same dollars that they have? So it's a different way of looking at it and different way of deploying the same dollars that you have, as opposed to getting threatened from a smaller player.
We could come back to you, Grant.
Okay.
Kurt always seems to have a ready answer for us.
Well, yeah. I mean, the general statement that I would take the most disagreement with is that cloud is a cheaper deployment method than anything else. And I think Tom yesterday kind of brought this up. What we see is cloud is so seductive and attractive, especially in the entertainment world, because you're laying out a common template. Everybody has to use it. And it's very concise, and it's very much the process is built into cloud. If you re-engineer cloud or you try to get a vendor who'll do that, you're just creating a BPO, right? You're just creating a custom solution and having somebody run it. So I've seen people come in heavy-handed and say, we're all going to be on this cloud solution. Nobody's going to vary. But then what they do is they recreate the integration problems. They start to want to pull the data out of the cloud, do special things with it, and they're recreating local applications based upon a cloud service, which, if you deal with the pay-per API call, it's a really expensive way of delivering IT services. So people have to understand that cloud means to conform to a business process built into the software, not to customize it, to understand when they're going to interact with that data and when they shouldn't. And it requires an awful lot of planning and maturity. And that is a challenge for our industry, is to not break down into lines of business and fiefdoms that do things differently. So cloud should be considered a challenge. It could be considered a way to optimize. The best illustration I know of is, look, if you bought a car and you paid for it, you didn't lease it, but you just paid it outright and you operated it till the wheels fell off, you'd be getting the cheapest transportation services possible. Cloud is more like leasing. You decide, I want a certain car, I want a certain style, I want a certain level of service, and I know that I'm paying the cost of money while I'm leasing. And that's kind of the maturity that I don't see yet hitting our discussions with the customers or the customers coming back at us. And I haven't heard it from the panel yet, that next generation. Next time I want to see people talking about MuleSoft and, you know, cloud integration technologies and how we do it. I was involved in a project at the studios where animated movies were constantly coming in over budget and late. So they paid a small company, Shotgun Software, to basically run a spy, which looked at the different buckets of animation from wireframe through skin application to lighting, and just counted how many frames were in each bucket so they knew what percentage complete the movies were, so they knew when people were going over budget and they were gonna be late, right? That's the maturity that we have to get to. And we will, pretty darn quickly.
So one of the things that I do want to talk about that I did not hear in any of the sessions earlier is we talked about workload and how different workloads are different. There are two aspects to workloads that I didn't see a lot of discussion about. One is depending on the type of workload, you want to decide whether you want to have it in-house in your private data center or you have in a managed hosting environment or a public. It truly depends on the type of workload. And the second is the way these workloads are being developed and designed is changing quite dramatically. If you look at Netflix, they are leveraging all of the principles of a cloud workload, and they are truly building something that's totally not relying on the underlying infrastructure. That's the characteristics of a cloud workload. If you look at traditional workloads, which 80% of the workloads are today, they depend heavily on the underlying infrastructure. And if the infrastructure goes down, the workload goes down. Whereas the newer workload, they are deployed in a multi-site model. They are loosely coupled modules so that even if the entire data center goes down, whether it's a public cloud data center or a private data center, the application is still servicing its customers. So the fundamental change in the way you design your workload and you deploy your workload is changing quite drastically. We should have more discussions around workloads and how they fit different cloud models.
Yeah, along the same lines, I don't know that I would necessarily disagree with anything that was said this morning. I think that a lot of the points are salient and on topic. I think that the one thing that gets lost, just thinking, up-leveling the conversation a little bit, is that the consumers seem to get lost in the entire conversation, right? People think so much time, take so much time thinking about how do we make the businesses run more efficiently, what's the process, how do we outsource these, are they internal clouds or external clouds? And I think that really at the end of the day, if you really look at the economics of the entertainment industry, it's all about matching up consumers with production, essentially. It's not even about studios at the end of the day. And I think that making that match more efficient and understanding how to develop audiences more efficiently is kind of a lacking piece of the conversation. Because I think it's all about what's the consumer choices they face right now in terms of content, and what types of content are the studios producing right now or the production houses producing right now. And then how do you make the matches between those two things? And I think that unless you can actually figure out a reasonable solution for that problem, the rest of it doesn't matter. I mean, reducing the operational cost of someone that doesn't know how to tell a story to a user and capture their discretionary free time doesn't really matter at the end of the day. And I think that there's such a shift coming in terms of consumer landscape that unless someone figures out how to solve that problem, the rest of it just is irrelevant.
Very good. I saw Mark sitting here making notes. He must have some fiery observations.
I work better when I can think. Our system was ready to go October 10th, right? Isn't that what the healthcare guys all said? Yeah. My system was, but his wasn't. So yeah. I'm IBM. My system was ready to go. SAP guys wasn't. Right? And I mean that jokingly. In that's one thing that I didn't think we talked too much about that I missed is that this ecosystem of providers is many of them are questionable, right? So make sure you qualify these new evolving vendors because, I mean, we saw, who's the object store guys that just bellied up a...
Irvonics, right?
Bellied up, right? Left a bunch of customers standing with object store stuff. So think about that ecosystem of the vendors. You don't want to put all your apples in one IBM basket, right? I don't encourage customers to do all IBM, but it is nice to have a single throat to choke somewhere in that chain.
Hand to
shake.
It's a love-hate relationship.
One back to Pat.
Yeah. Because I've seen these things blow up right in front. So I would say that that's a key thing. And that the other was this, that it's not cheaper, right? I use the iPad analysis, but the other one I always tell people is get a spreadsheet out and I'll help you put it together. And here's the way you put it together. Is if you're gonna do cloud, I'm gonna charge you $1 a day for this infrastructure, right? Pay as you go, $1 a day. But by the way, on Easter Sunday, when you've got to blow out the capacity, I'm charging you $1 million. Because you're gonna take more resources than you'd ever planned on, you're blowing up my infrastructure, I'm gonna charge you a lot for that. So over the year, you're gonna pay $1,011,000. Or I'll charge you $100,000 a month, right? And you own it. At the end of the year, you pay for the maximum capacity. You will pay the same amount, I propose, and possibly more for the convenience of not having to have the infrastructure in your data center. So somebody in the chain of a workload and delivering that workload has to pay for Easter Sunday or Christmas shopping holidays, that maximum capacity. It's not gonna be IBM, we're not gonna take a loss. It's the customers. So cloud is not cheaper, and the best thing you can do, and I like that, right, because that should have been the top part of my strategy, is that you've got to fight that battle, right? Everybody wants cloud, it's going to be cheaper. It absolutely will not be cheaper. It'll allow you to innovate quicker, deliver quicker, and compete better, but it will not be cheaper. Yeah. So that's what I'm saying.
So Grant?
I might disagree with that a little bit, actually.
Good.
I agree. If you look at the cost of compute in an on-prem traditional environment versus the cost of compute in an on-demand cloud environment, particularly Easter Sunday, you're right. If you're comparing those two metrics, it's not going to be cheaper. The conversation that we have with our customers over and over again is, how much does it cost you to have the people that are really specialized and really understand your business deeply in the data center racking servers or spinning up VMs or doing any of the things that go into managing the infrastructure versus focused on the applications that actually make the business work? So, and I'll keep going back to the example that I gave. It's a little silly, but they had their animators in the soundstage racking servers, and they did this every time they did a production. These guys are animators. They're not, they're not construction guys. They're like racking up racks in the soundstage. How much does it cost? One of the things that we've seen is IT has become more and more important as a foundation of all companies, regardless of whether they're technology or media or anything else, right? So the demand on IT resources, particularly people, keeps growing year over year, but those resources aren't growing typically, right? So you've got IT guys that are running around trying to keep up with the nuts and bolts of the infrastructure rather than being focused on really strategic business process improvements and applications. And I think the conversation that we have with our customers is say, all right, if you don't have to worry about the underlying infrastructure, that's just taken care of. And now the limited resources that you have can actually focus on what's important. How much does that save you in terms of opportunity cost? Mm-hmm. And it's a lot more difficult to model than how much is a VM here versus here, but usually we find that customers say, I get it. This is what cloud's about.
Okay, so now we're going to take a little bit of a turn. We're going to go back to those Manolos, ladies. Apparently that's the thing here. So from the consumer perspective, how will the media and entertainment sector's continuing adoption of cloud-based solutions impact viewing, listening, game playing, these behaviors? What do you believe will be the greatest change in the usage patterns? So why don't we start with Kurt this time?
Okay.
Oh no. Oh. Yeah,
I think what will change is the personalization of content. So if you don't know, and I hate to create an NSA-style scandal, but...
No.
So your TV has had the capability of watching you since the advent of a cable set-top box. It's pretty simple. You have an account with your cable company. You have a set-top box that has a unique identifier on it. And every time you ask to see a channel, it has to ask for the unscramble code. And that's how you get to watch television off a set-top box. Well, guess what? We can log every time you do a channel change, so we know what channels you're watching. It's pretty simple. Now, with the ability to actually extract who's watching what when, we can start to do different things. Like, you know, Nielsen has been just one wild ass guess about who's watching what. You know, a poor statistical model with a really small sample size. Well, it's within our ability to actually know how many people on every cable system watch what channel. And that will mean that your preferences will matter more. That will mean that your content will matter more. And by the way, if we do it on iPads and phones, it's only going to get better because we can more finely determine who is on those devices and what they're watching, and in most cases, where they're watching it. So, you know, the tyranny of New York and LA being the biggest audiences kind of gets reduced a little bit. We can normalize and understand who's watching what where. I mean, one of my personal things that I laugh about, and it's one of my great customers makes it, is Duck Dynasty. Okay, Duck Dynasty just misses me. I'm an Irish-Mexican kid from San Diego who lives in LA. Duck Dynasty misses me.
Totally.
Right? But there are people who love this. I went into my sporting goods store, and there's a whole line of licensed products based on Duck Dynasty.
Okay.
Right?
Who knows what Duck Dynasty is?
Oh, yeah.
I'm with you. No idea.
Yes,
no idea.
I'm in the minority. Go ahead.
So, you know, my point is, we will have better content, more aligned to our own preferences. We'll be brought into more content and different things. I'm the father of a five-year-old, and I'm amazed to see, especially there's a rapid adoption in kids' TV of things like there are more Desi themes, right? There are more North African themes. There are more cross-cultural themes coming in. And it's going to allow us all to get introduced to a lot more interesting things, because anything exciting will be fair for attracting you. I mean, think about how many of us have sophisticated tastes in restaurants, and we'll go eat 100 different types of cuisine, right? That's going to happen with our content palette. It'll blow up, it'll get much better, and it'll be a lot more fun. Unfortunately, those of us in the entertainment business are going to have to work 10 times as hard to make the same amount of money, but we'll have much better tools to do it with. So.
Thank you.
I agree to a lot of what Kurt said. It's changing the way we view everything from a consumer standpoint. I have so many different devices that I view the content through. I no longer view when it's scheduled or when it's available. I just record it. I view it whenever I want. I can view it in the night when my kids are sleeping. Kids can view it at their time. Everything's being recorded. Everything's on demand. So from a consumer standpoint, it's changing the way it's viewed from a programming standpoint. From a broadcasting and from a marketing perspective, one of the things that providers can do now is when you develop a show, you can develop and fail fast. Fail often, fail fast, and then figure out what works for your consumer base, what works for your target audience. And because you can fail often, fail fast, and fail cheaply, that way you can, the ones that are successful, you can spend more money towards that and do a better job at that. So it's targeted audience, targeted broadcasting, but then again, you try out smaller things and see what stays with the consumer base.
I think that one of the most interesting things to look at right now is the big four television networks. So look at ABC, NBC, Fox, and CBS, and just how much their business has changed over the last 50 years. And they used to be getting like these 30% or 30 million, 30% market share ratings for their shows, right? Now if they get 1.5 million users watching a show, they're ecstatic. And typically it's gonna be in the hundreds of thousands of people watching a show. They're spending hundreds of millions of dollars producing a huge stable of primetime shows that hardly anybody watches because there's 150, 500 other channels that are on competing with them. And I think that that's just the tip of the iceberg. Because what you're seeing there is really just cable television programming coming into competition with what used to be over-the-air broadcast, right? And I think that that trend is just going to continue. There's a really good book, and I almost hate to give away my good reference for free here. The best book I've ever read on the entertainment industry, and one of the ones that I'm most passionate about, is this book called Economics of the Entertainment Industry by Harold Vogel. I don't know if you've read that one or not.
I have it.
It's a great, great book, and it just walks through all the different driving factors that contribute to user mindset, how studios react to different situations, things like that. I can't remember if it's the beginning of chapter 3 or beginning of chapter 4, I have the seven trends or seven fundamental principles of the entertainment industry, regardless of whether it's music or movies or television. And one of them is that fragmentation just continues no matter what. And no matter, it'll expand to the amount of distribution bandwidth that you have available. So you'll come up with more and more targeted, more and more personalized, more and more specific niche content, the more distribution channels that you have available. Cable's a perfect example. They expand cable plans so they can carry 500 channels, and now you no longer have primetime comedy and primetime drama. Now you have the Food Network, the Travel Channel, Discovery, TLC, and probably 300 others that I've never even watched, Telemundo. Maybe one of these days I'll pick up Spanish. But that fragmentation is just going to continue and continue. And what that means for the entertainment industry is that they can't keep putting money into big production budgets, right? You see, and I think this is going to really bite them in the near term future. You see, for example, the big ABC Studios or Warner Studios or those guys continuing to put $100 million into a television series for 22 episodes or 13 episodes or however many it is. And the problem is that most of those shows get canceled. Year in, year out. I think they look at 300 scripts a year. They produce 2% of them, and of those, probably about 80% of them get canceled. We were working with ABC Network. We were looking at a new show they were coming out with, Lucky 7. I think it made it about 2 episodes before it got canceled. They always have 3, 4 more on the back burner just in case. But just because they're counting on their shows failing that fast. I mean, it's the fail fast and adapt model, but they're doing it with $100 million bets, which is not, in my opinion, the best way to go about it. So I think that if you start looking at it, production costs really have to come down. They have to start spending a lot less on production to be able to provide consumers with the variety of content. So you can have the cycling channel, you can have kids programming, you can have alternate language content, you can have the kayaking channel. I mean, whatever people are interested in. And I think they need to make sure that it's relevant, it's the stories are topical, and it's getting back to the really core of the content rather than special effects that make it glitz and glamour. Another thing that I think is really going to impact consumers, and I'm a little bit bitter that Kurt started hitting on this one before I got a chance to, is the cross-media aspect of it. And you start seeing studios talking a lot about merchandising, about cross-promoting shows, about comic books becoming movies, movies becoming television shows becoming products, products becoming movies, movies becoming comic books, and that's another one of these fundamental principles of the entertainment industry is kind of a story will cross across all media. And I think that from a consumer perspective, this gives you rich universes to live in. No longer is it about, hey, I like Iron Man or I like the Avengers and I can watch a movie or I can watch part of that series. Now it's they cross all genres and you can get as immersed and as in-depth into it as you want to. And I think that it's almost... I don't want to go on a political rant here, but it's almost what you see in politics right now. People get very entrenched in their own way of thinking. They get immersed in their own world. I think that media is going to allow people to get immersed in their own opinions and their own views of the world and become part of their own world and absorbed into their own world in a very new way that you used to have a lot of cross-person media, and you're going to have very niche silos that people live in going forward. And I think that provide, if you can pull people into those niches, if you can pull people into a Modern Family niche, into an Avengers niche, into a Big Bang Theory niche, and get them to live in that universe, no longer is it about, hey, we have one series that you watch or one episode that you really liked. It's, hey, we have someone that keeps coming back for more and we can own them for a much longer duration of the lifespan of that consumer. And I think that's good for consumers that really find content that they like, and it's good for studios that have to figure out how to monetize those consumers on an ongoing basis.
So is this sort of like why you sit there and watch TV and then it's like, wait, is this an infomercial for the studio that produced it or for the, you know, network that produced it? Or am I looking at an advertisement for the, it's like, I haven't gotten out of, you know, you think you're going to bicycles and you're still back into the original thing, so.
Yeah. I just pose it. Does anybody know who owns Redbox? Who is the company behind Redbox?
Coinstar.
Absolutely. And so that's my point, is that Coinstar, the guys that collect coins from the grocery stores and the machines, are the company behind Redbox. And so with cloud, you know, it's about innovation. There's an opportunity for a traditional brick and mortar company to evolve into something totally different. So beware, right, of your competitors. And to that, I mean, I also pick the flip side, which is Woolco and Woolworth, mm-hmm. right? Where are they? They were Walmart. Where are they, right? So they're also an opportunity for a very traditional brick and mortar company to be toast in this kind of world.
You're aware of what Coinstar recently said about Redbox, right? Huh. Mature business that they need to figure out how to transition its decline.
Oh, they just
like
need
that.
To merge with Netflix. I mean, yeah. there's the marriage in heaven right there. Yeah. Those two companies, right? Yeah. Say that, you know, but to your point, those usage patterns are critical, and I'm waiting for the cable provider that can deliver me the thing, and everybody gets it. So like, I'm flipping through the channels, and I see a show I want to watch, and I say, yeah, I want to watch that show, and it says, denied, you're not approved to watch that show. Why in the hell doesn't it right then sell me that show? Mm-hmm. Right then. Why doesn't it say, hey, by the way, Mark, for the last 5 weeks, for some reason, you're an idiot, you don't know what your package is, you keep saying you want to watch this channel, and you don't have this channel. I've done it hundreds of times, till I think it's NGTV or something. I want to watch, you know, the Andy Tyler or any girl. No, I'm... Why doesn't it let me know then? If it's got HANA and it's got streaming, mm-hmm. right then, it should tell me.
You know, actually, John Malone proposed, I guess it was 2 weeks ago, that the major MSOs get together to create a streaming service yep. so that they could do basically that.
Yeah, that's what the consumers yeah. want. Yeah. I mean, so.
I cut my cable 3-4 years ago, at least. I watch everything online, the few things that I do, but when I go on vacation, I go to the Middle East and, you know, get in the middle of conflicts. That's my idea of vacation. But so, cool. So I've been watching.
Come to my house.
You know, to the point, I've been watching.
Don't bring a wife and kids.
No, but I've been watching Al Jazeera online for years because yeah. you know, I've got friends in the Middle East, and you couldn't do that until very, very recently, and only in certain areas. But you know, to the point, that frustration is exactly why I said, you know, you can go online, you can stream what you want. What's, you know, the MSOs want to play catch up to everybody else. Okay, it's just I think consumers are going to move past that.
I think people lose track of the fact that everyone's very excited about digital. Digital is obviously the next big thing. The future is obviously digital, but all the money is still in broadcast. Mm-hmm. All the money is still tied up in the existing yeah. Nielsen crazy yeah. statistics, mm-hmm. big market, broad, mass advertising economy. And so even if you go to the digital guys inside these studios, they're at a loss because they know that they're the future and the studio knows that they're the future, but they have no power to actually yeah. implement anything because nobody wants that change
they
to come about because
mm-hmm.
all your billions of dollars are still tied up in broadcast.
That is true, but I think we're just starting to see the very beginnings of a change. You know, look at like House of Cards, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, phenomenally successful. They won. Mm-hmm. A couple of the awards, I think.
Yeah.
And so you're just now starting to see, all right, there are people that are signing up on Netflix specifically for that content that you yeah. can't get in broadcast.
Mm-hmm. Orange is the New Black, yeah. Arrested Development. I mean, they have a lot of really good hit shows. They're a huge threat. They could very well be the next big MSO. Mm-hmm. I think the market has proven time and time again, there's only room for 6 really big MVPDs, whether that's Comcast and Dish Network, Time Warner, whoever those players are. I mean, there's just by legacy a huge amount of smaller players in the United States because they ran the cables to begin with. But really, it starts accumulating into these big players. And I think that there's the potential that the Hulus, the Amazons, the Netflixes of the world could really become the next big MSOs if the MSOs don't figure out how to transition the user base. Although the MSOs have done a great job in the past of defending their turf. We'll just see if they can figure out how to break free of their own trillions of dollars of infrastructure that they've already put in the ground. Okay.
While this panel is so fired up, how about questions from the audience? Of course, Mr. Back of the Room.
You had a shout out earlier, man. You weren't in the room.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, apologize. So you brought up something interesting. As somebody who works for an infrastructure company, in this case, CenturyLink and Savvis. One of the things that I didn't hear you address, and I may have missed it, I apologize if I did, is the fact that, you know, the likes of Netflix, for example, and other companies in that space have a fundamental problem with scale in the terms of their network costs. And the number that's used quite often is that once you get to roughly 8,000 concurrent users, the economics of IPTV go upside down. And it costs you more to deliver than you could ever generate in revenue. right? So those businesses don't scale in a way that any kind of anything that we recognize as television scales, right? So what do you think those businesses become as they get bigger? Do they simply avoid ever having to try to serve an audience of more than 8,000 concurrent users? Do they fundamentally change the economics? Do they buy infrastructure? I mean, Google's doing Google Fiber, you know, but companies like the Netflixes and Amazons of the world that don't own significant infrastructure, I think, have a fundamental problem with scale, and I'd be curious what you guys think about that.
Wasn't multicast supposed to fix that?
Only if people are watching it at the same time. Yeah. Which kind of defeats the whole
Which goes back to broadcast, right? Yeah. And it's way cheaper to do that via satellite, and that's right. The real fundamental challenge. It just doesn't scale.
Back in the 1960s, there was an economist that said, by the year 2000, we'll be out of food, and there'll be mass famine across the entire world. And he was absolutely right by the models that he was using that day and extrapolating the data, and he put a lot of thought into it. The problem is that he didn't anticipate technology changes. He didn't anticipate how new technologies were going to produce more food in smaller area, make it cheaper. I think the same thing applies to Netflix and all those guys. I think that bandwidth will become cheaper, infrastructure will become cheaper. I mean, that's like shooting fish in a barrel right there. But I think that that's really what makes them economically viable in the long run, is bandwidth becomes so incredibly cheap that they don't have to worry about it anymore. The other flip side of that is it may not be the technology and the economics that really dictate whether or not Netflix is successful, but more legality, right? How does network neutrality shake out? Can the MSOs charge them for delivering shows over your broadband connection? Those sorts of things. And that's all in the realm of politics, so we'll leave that one up to the politics to figure out.
Yeah, and I'd say, to your point, it's a point in time, right, that, you know, technology evolves so quickly that I think some of those bandwidth issues will be resolved with new technologies. But I also know that consumers are willing to pay for what they want. Mm-hmm. And I think what example is House of Cards, right? Under that 8,000 subscriber model, you may hit but because that's such a popular, people will pay more. People will pay a premium. Back to it's not cheaper. I think if you can build, you know, you kind of cast out with chum, right, when you're fishing, right? So they're chumming right now out there in the market. And once they get some big ones, then you'll see that cost model, I think, flip on just the opposite of that.
I just want to add one more thing. In addition to, definitely the cost of bandwidth is going down drastically. 10 gigs, 100 gigs, now people are talking about a lot more than that. And we have seen the early signs of it. If you look at the telephone industry, how many people are ditching their landline and just using either voice over IP or just using cell phones? So the trend is going that way. I know the telephone requires a lot less bandwidth than a video or a movie, but the trend is going that way, and the cost of bandwidth is definitely going down.
Okay, we had a question here.
Just to really compliment what you said with, when it comes to the IPTV platforms, you know, some of the issues that are taking place is those relationships are also being bonded with the LTE platforms and the new mobile platforms to kind of offload some of that multicasting, as we're talking about. As we move forward, that's there. But I want to just add to what you talked about before, the new models with the set-top boxes and capturing. It's a little frightening. So privacy issues are something that we're all addressing, especially from targeted advertising, not so much on programming, if you have interests there. But there's another model that's coming forward to what kind of where Adam was going a little bit, and that was the evolution of where many of the other ecosystem providers are starting to offer, and that's in the glass makers, the television makers, as well as the programmers are starting to capture the data directly off the screen. So the set-top box's value is actually looking to start diminishing because of the capability of being able to capture where the information's coming from, whether it's a game console or a device, or whether it's from a set-top box. And that's going to change the dynamics completely. Your comments on that, of whether or not that evolution, because right now we're making 1.5% on the glass, and by being able to build a new data model in to capture it, it actually could they could increase that percentage by 1% and double their revenues.
It's funny, as you're saying that, I'm wondering, is it too early to proclaim that smart TVs are dead? There's this big hype around smart TVs, and it just seems like the people bought their smart TVs, maybe a few people use them, but they haven't really gotten that critical mass to really show that the consumer wants to pick up their TV remote and use their smart TV. The other thing is, it was interesting talking to Sam Rosen, the analyst from ABI, He was saying that they just initiated coverage on set-top boxes again, the qualitative analysis of set-top boxes again. They'd stopped it for a while because everyone's going to smart TVs. It's no longer about set-top boxes. Set-top boxes are surely nails in the coffin. You can hear them dying off everywhere. Now, flash forward to a few years later, now it's like, oh, wait, maybe set-top boxes, good components that you can throw away and refresh every year, rather than having to go buy a new TV every few years as they become outdated. Maybe set-top boxes are the way of the future all over again. So,
okay, we have one last question, then a break, and then we'll reconvene.
Back to the IPTV 8,000 limit or whatever. I mean, that sort of is based on a single point of origin topology, right? When you start to change the topology of the IPTV network, then you actually isolate peaks in bandwidth, and you can actually isolate it within space and time, because in general, 10% of the content is getting 90% of the views. Mm-hmm. And so it's very easy to edge cache and time cache and do other things. So you can very rapidly move from completely live television to paused live television, and you know, I pause it for 5 seconds, he pauses it for 10, he pulls it 15, somebody comes in an hour later to watch what has just happened. I mean, the topologies are don't have to be point to point, right? It's very much pushing to the edge, local caching, et cetera, and then the IPTV system works pretty damn well. You know, I wouldn't want to have, 8,000 people watching 8,000 different things, right? But if, you know, half of them are watching one thing, even if they're shifted in time, I can support that very, very easily. And it doesn't even require the cost of bandwidth to come down, though people like me are praying it does.
No, I think you're spot on.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Bandwidth does come down. I mean, so when we were selling bandwidth in 1997 for $1,800 a megabit, lucky to get 50 cents today. So, I mean, you know, that 8,000 number user, I mean, I'm sure that was true at a point in time, but I think you're right. That number keeps growing and growing and growing, and the cost keeps going down and down. And as you get a critical mass of users simultaneously, you know, using IPT or viewing IPTV content, the law of large numbers comes into play, and those spikes and valleys, you know, that averages out. And the long tail content moves up to the top and so forth.
Yeah, and I'd also add that I think Netflix is making money, right? They're profitable. Mm-hmm.
They are.
More than 8,000 customers.
Somehow they managed to somehow they managed to consume 30% of the internet's bandwidth and be profitable at the same time.
Yeah.
I don't know the number.
I think it's 40 million.
Well, and I would add just to the discussion about set-top boxes and bandwidth, you see an incredible amount of time and effort being put into devices and alternative ways to deliver content. One of my favorites now is the Google Chromecast. It's a $35 2-gigabyte PC on a stick you stick into an HDMI port, and you use a tablet or a smartphone to actually cast. So that tablet and cell phone or what have your identity authenticate you to the service, establish a stream, and then that stream is just transferred to a device. So, I mean, smart TVs could go away. They can become more dumb terminals. We can do data casting off the devices that we already own. The cost of those devices is going down, down, down. If you look at, like, I live in a Fios neighborhood where I've got a really dumb connection coming from fiber to an O to E. I mean, there's all the different wavelengths of light that could come off that fiber link connection. So there are pathways to do this. I don't think there's any question that it's going to move forward, but it's going to be a hell of an area of experimentation. And if you look at people like Google and Intel spending their dollars to go innovate into those devices, those are going to just be with us in the future. We're going to experiment with a ton of models. The principles of identity and capturing a stream and descrambling that stream will be there in whatever device. But you know, it's going to be a wild ride. As I said, I think we're going to have a ton of content, a fun future, but we're going to be working really hard for the next 10 years figuring it out.
The Chromecast is the next set-top box, right?
Yeah.
That's right.
Let us thank our panelists.